This is court number 19-00218, Vietnam Fine Wood Company Limited et al. Versus the United States. The Honorable Mark A. Barnett presiding. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
This is Gregory F. Menegas from DeKeefer and Horrigan on behalf of plaintiffs Vietnam Fine Wood, Far East American, and Interglobal Forest. And I'm joined today by Judith Holdsworth and Vivian Wong of my law firm.
This is Ellen Murphy and Nicole Lorette of Forrest, Harrington, and Sutcliffe for Plaintiff Intervenor Liberty Woods International.
On behalf of the government, this is Hardeep Josen from the Department of Justice, and with me I also have Joseph Clark from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and Michelle Lynch and Savannah Maxwell from the Department of Commerce.
Okay.
I think that's everyone, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, everyone, for joining this morning. I appreciate you getting on the phone today. I hope everyone's doing well. I know this is, sometimes for a status conference, I mean, doing it by phone will suffice. But we're still not in normal times. May I ask who just joined?
Hi, this is Vivian Wong. I apologize. I was out of the line earlier.
Yep, not a problem. Okay. One of the challenges that we face sometimes, in doing these teleconferences is, you know, things happen, we get disconnected, we've got to call back in. So apologies for the little snafus that may happen along the way. But again, I appreciate everyone getting on the line, and I hope everyone and their families are all doing well. We've had a lot of activity in the last couple of weeks in this case. And as I was reading through a lot of the materials, thinking about how the additional information impacts the issues before the court, a number of questions arose in my mind, and I thought it would be most productive, most helpful, most efficient to get everyone on the call, get everyone on a call at once, and we could go through some of these questions and see exactly where everyone is, both with regard to a couple of factual clarifications as well as some questions about the legal position. I think what I'd like to do is I'm going to go through these questions, and in asking these questions, I mean, I'll pose the question initially either to Mr. Menegas or to Ms. Josen. Ms. Murphy, don't feel left out. I think what I'd like to do in terms of efficiency's sake is come to you at the end. The last question I have is with respect to the factual situation with regard to your client. And then if you'd be kind enough to just, track along as we go through these questions, I'm happy to then go back through and determine if there are any particular questions where the facts are distinct for your client, or if your client's got different legal positions with regard to any of the issues that we've discussed. But I think it'd probably be most efficient to go through that way.
That's fine, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any initial questions from anybody in terms of how we're going to go today, Ben? Okay. Let me start off then with you, Mr. Menegas. Question that if you've read through the comments that the government filed towards the end of the day yesterday, may not come as a surprise, but I had flagged it earlier, and that was on page 3 of your comments on the defendant's statement. You say, and I'm quoting, defendant has the authority to void the liquidations pursuant to 19 U.S.C. 1501. What's the legal support for your statement that they can void the liquidations, given that 1501 refers only to reliquidating entries?
Well, our legal position is that the power to reliquidate includes the power to suspend, and their regulation implementing that statute says that the court director can take all appropriate action to correct.
And what's the citation?
Let's see. It's 19 CFR parts 173.2. And Judge Barnett, we're currently checking with our clients because we believe that there were some liquidations in the normal course. You know, when an entry is coded 1, not subject to dumping, there's a typical 314-day clock where it will just liquidate in the normal course of business unless there's some reason not to. And we thought we had one of our clients have that happen, and then Customs went back under the statute and, you know, unliquidated it. So we're checking right now. We obviously haven't had a lot of time to react to their comments. But that's our position, that inherent within the power to reliquidate and correct mistakes is the power to unliquidate. And I don't think there's any case law on this, and I don't, you know, the Justice Department didn't cite any case law one way or the other.
Okay. Ms. Jossan?
Thank you, Your Honor. Our position remains that although 1501 allows Customs to reliquidate an entry within 90 days, it does not allow Customs to void or unset or reset that liquidation. And again, plaintiffs have not cited to any other authority. We also think carbonated activated pretty much speaks on point here, that when there is an inadvertent premature liquidation, the proper avenue would be to protest that liquidation and not, you know, it doesn't bestow jurisdiction now on the case, but you must protest that. And, you know, again, there's no authority to void these liquidations once they've been liquidated, whether that's inadvertent or in error.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me go back to Mr. Menegas. I'm looking at the regulation that you're pointing me to. And again, the language of the regulation is, I won't say it tracks because it's obviously there's more there than what's in the statute, but I mean, it says the center director may review transactions for correctness, take appropriate action under his general authority to correct errors, including those in appraisement where appropriate, at the time of liquidation of an entry, voluntary reliquidation, voluntary correction of an exaction, reliquidation made pursuant, and modification pursuant to a protest. I mean, you've been practicing in this area long enough. I mean, we all know there are clear distinctions between the idea of reliquidating and voiding a liquidation. Again, I would ask, if you've got any specific precedent that you can point me to for the idea that the ability to reliquidate includes the ability to void a liquidation, and as I would understand your position, you know, reset or return to unliquidated status particular entry.
Of course, we have the Infong case,
That's pursuant to a court order. That's not based on the agency's authority. And your statement was that the defendant, the United States government, has the authority to void the liquidations. I mean, that was done pursuant to consent to a court order.
But the court ordered them to do it or show cause why they couldn't do it, and they chose to do it. The court didn't order them to resuspend the entry, in our understanding.
My understanding of looking at the papers was they consented to a court order to reliquidate, to reset. I mean,
and their alternative was to show cause why they couldn't do it.
Ms. Jossan, do you have any more information on that one?
I don't, Your Honor. My understanding as well is it was based on an order. And again, we're not arguing that a court can't order to reset, but again, there's a jurisdictional hurdle here first that has to be addressed. So,
absolutely.
With that in mind, from the paper, from my understanding, in FANG, it was consent to, you know,
right.
The court ordering to reset the liquidation.
Right. And there's other challenges with regard to Infang, and we'll get to that a little bit later. Okay. Let me ask you, I mean, and this sort of follows up, I think, on the point that Mr. Sand just made, and that is, Mr. Menegas, you argue that it's within the court's power also to restore the status of the entries. But again, you know, isn't going to the point that Mr. Sun just made, isn't the court's power dependent first upon the court having jurisdiction? So that even if, you know, there's an equitable need to restore the entries to unliquidated status, I mean, that's, isn't that by itself at least insufficient to provide jurisdiction to the court if the jurisdiction doesn't otherwise exist?
Well, we think the jurisdiction that it now exists for two different reasons. The reasons we originally articulated and by the fact of the liquidations under Zenith and its progeny cited by Judge Gordon in Infall.
Spell that out for me a little bit. How does Zenith make a how is Zenith relevant here? Because the part of what made part of the legal basis for the Zenith finding was the whole injunction structure in pursuant to 1516A, and we're not in 1516. We may be in C, but we're not in 1516A. We're in 1517, without which doesn't have the same injunction. Based implementation structure.
Well, I think what we, you know, we've seen, I mean, that's one of the challenges of this new law is that, you know, we had no reason to seek an injunction because we had no reason to believe they would liquidate the entries. And so, nonetheless, in the standard trade case, you know, where C jurisdiction is provided, 2815, you know, USC 1581C, in all the past cases where the entries liquidated, it became a problem for the judge to assert jurisdiction under C. And that's where the judges have said they, you know, they lose jurisdiction. So the, you know, the government has said in its final reply
that may be the case, but, I mean, Mr. Menegas, I mean, anytime you're operating under a new law, you can't just go and say, hey, this all this precedent necessarily applies. You have to actually look at the basis for the precedent and explain why the basis for that precedent it applies under this new statute. You haven't done any of that.
Well, I mean, the agency, this is different in many respects from these other cases in that this is a law that is designed for customs to be administered by customs. And, you know, we dispute that they've made these liquidations inadvertently, and we think because the law required them to suspend and they have the ability
to correct. Mr. Menegas, you're getting I mean, let's go back to the question, okay? I mean, you've done this sort of throughout a lot of your papers, and it's kind of frustrating. I mean, the issue before the court, the first issue that I have to decide is jurisdiction. So you can tell me the saddest story in the world, but it doesn't, by, you know, no matter how sad it is, that doesn't get you jurisdiction. You have to focus on the specific question. And so, you know, I mean, again, how does this get us to a jurisdictional issue?
You're saying how does the mere liquidation of the entries get us to a jurisdictional issue?
Is that right? Does that change anything with respect to the jurisdictional question before the court?
Well, we've maintained in our pleadings that there's at a minimum there's a strong parallel between that a long line of precedents that say the court will not assert C jurisdiction when the entries have liquidated. And so,
but
we think there's a parallel
I'm
there.
I'm asking you to address because, I mean, frankly, in subsequent case law, I mean, the courts, the Federal Circuit as well, has been very clear about sort of the basis for what happened in Zenith, and that it was really a function of the injunction authority that's provided for in 1516A. And so we're not in 1516A. I mean, if you look at the subsequent case law in terms of, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, Chenier or, I mean, Parkdale or, you know, I think even Sumek, I think, got into that very within just the past year or so. It's, you know, it really, you have to track back to the legal basis for that precedent that you're trying to rely on, and the legal basis seems inapplicable to your case. So, I mean, and I'm not saying that it means the opposite, that you necessarily lose on that basis. It, what it means is you have to start from scratch. You have to actually build your legal case. You can't just say, well, Zenith, and expect me to rely on it. You got to actually do the work, that the same kind of work that led to the Zenith case of explaining the situation.
Well, you know, we would also argue that the liquidations are part of the entire circumstance of the unreasonableness of their of attempts to apply this law from the beginning to the end, and that under the 1581I cases, that talk about extraordinary circumstances, we think we are in those extraordinary circumstances. And the government in their first motion to dismiss, I believe at page 8, talks about, under Kemsol, that when relief is realistically available under another subsection, 1581I would not apply. And, we acknowledge that, but we're trying to make the case here that the totality of the circumstances have gotten us to a place where we don't have a reasonable path to see jurisdiction in this case.
Or, do you mean to actually say that see jurisdiction is now as a result of the liquidations, the see jurisdiction would be manifestly inadequate, and therefore...
As a result of that and these other... circumstances, but which we've outlined in the past, and I wouldn't mind summarizing again for you here. But the government has one sentence in their last pleading that I think that says, well, you're perfectly fine to go forward under C, despite the liquidations, and they have no authority either for that. And we anticipate that if that eventually happens several years down the road, when we finally get the chance to go to court. And we're coming on our 2-year anniversary of this proceeding, by the way, in July. They will immediately move.
Menegas, again,
because
focus
the entry
on
is
the jurisdiction issues. I mean, I understand,
right, so,
we got a lot of issues, but spend less time digressing on the tale of woe and more time focusing on the relevant stuff, please.
Right. Well, the relevant cases say that in extraordinary circumstances, and when there's not a reasonable path to seek jurisdiction, the court will assert I jurisdiction.
Okay.
And that's the merits of our case, from the beginning to the end, in the way, Customs has handled this issue of the scope referral. And they've essentially leveraged a 360-day investigation into at least a 600 or 700-day investigation. Is completely unreasonable and denies us that path to, a reasonable and timely way to, have a decision that we can appeal under C. And we know of no other case. There have been like 20 or 30 EDIPA cases. There's no case where they made the referral, at 3:25 on the last business day of the case. Of a fully extended case with government tolling on top of it. There's nothing close to it. This is an extraordinary circumstance. I know you don't want me to summarize our whole entire set of pleadings, but I wouldn't object to doing something like that quickly. So when you this is a collection of events, including these liquidations, which, it's not credible that they were unintentional. A lot of the law that says you have to protest involves unintentional liquidations when they were attempting to administer a Commerce Department law ministerially, and they did something erroneous. But this is their law, and they told us that they liquidated the entries intentionally when they were the ones that, in fact, coded them Type 3 in the first place.
This is Judith Holdsworth. May I say something?
Do we have you, Judge Barnett?
Your Honor, are you still on the line? Kylie or Tyler, can you check and see if the...
Okay. I'm back. Ms. Wong, I feel the pain.
Very good.
Okay.
All right. I got dropped off there in a little, sort of in the middle of Mr. Menegas's response.
Yeah, I'm not sure where we left it, but I think what I was saying is the liquidations are just part of a collection of events that we've addressed in our pleadings that fit into this category of extraordinary circumstances where we've been denied a reasonable path to a C appeal because Commerce Customs never made a decision by the last business day of their case. And they only referred it in the last 2 hours of the 360th day plus 37 days of tolling. And in the 20 to 30 EIPA cases that we've researched, they've never done anything close to approximating this. This is an extraordinary circumstance. And everything about it from the beginning to the end is extraordinary.
Right. Okay. I mean, I understand
Excuse me.
Of your argument. Yes.
May I also add something? This is Judith Holdsworth from DeKeefer & Horgan.
Okay. I mean, I'll let you go this one time, but I would appreciate if counsel for a party could coordinate their argument and have just one person presenting. But go ahead, Ms. Holdsworth.
Yes, we've definitely tried to do that at a distance, and sometimes it's a little bit difficult. But just the one statement that on page 4 of this response to our comments, where the government says, well, there's no indication that 1581C jurisdiction would not apply. And I believe that the precedent said the government did not tell us why it wouldn't apply, just as you have asked us to go back to the basis and then determine how this case is different from all of the precedents. The government has failed to do that, and I don't believe that either the government or the court could.
Well, again, Ms. Holdsworth, I mean, you're the plaintiff. Okay, Ms. Holdsworth, you're the plaintiff. The burden is on the plaintiff to establish jurisdiction. It's not on the government. Okay, and so that's why I'm starting with you and Mr. Menegas. So
mm-hmm.
Let me just go. Ms. Josan, do you have anything you want to say in response?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. For us, the jurisdictional issue was pretty straightforward. When you look at what's alleged in the amended complaint, this is all about CBP's inaction or failures during the conduct of its investigation. I won't go at length. I know you've read our motion papers for dismissing the action, but it all goes back to them seeking a negative evasion determination. That's the true nature of the case here that they're going after. There will be jurisdiction under C at the conclusion of that EIPA investigation. Now, the fact that the entries have been liquidated subsequent to the filing of this action, prematurely, you know, we agree they should not have been liquidated. However, that, again, does not give the court jurisdiction under I to hear the causes of actions that they've alleged in their complaint, which is, again, the inactions by CBP. So I still don't see how jurisdiction under I can be had to the extent that in liquidation premature.
But part of the question for I jurisdiction is whether C is going to be manifestly inadequate. And part of their claim for relief is the liquidation of the entries that were the subject of the investigation without regard to anti-dumping or countervailing duties. I mean, it's part of their request for relief, and it's directly tied to the case, and that's part of what makes their argument that the C jurisdiction would be inadequate is whether they're going to be able to get any of this money back. And I mean, we're going to come to some of those questions, I think, mm-hmm. as we go forward. But I know I interrupted you there. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that thought?
Sure. Again, the manifest inadequacy, I haven't heard anything on that front from plaintiffs. But aside from that, I do agree that under Zenith and the case law there, that does deal with the different statute, 1516A versus 1517. And 1517 does not have any of that similar language. With the premature liquidations, and I'm sure, you will get into this, as we've said in our papers, there is a remedy there as well. To the extent they're now challenging the premature liquidations, they can file a protest with Customs. That has not, that time frame is still there for them to do so. And that's how they would protect their rights under that. Short of that.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll get to that in due course. So let me just turn back then to Mr. Menegas, and this is one of those factual questions that I'm trying to I want to sort through. I mean, with regard to what has been liquidated here, are there any entries that are subject of the ongoing EPA investigation that continue to be suspended, or were all of the entries liquidated?
Our understanding from both of our importer clients is that they were all liquidated. And we had a conference call among the five targeted importers, and that was our understanding, that these liquidation notices had all gone out to all five importers in the span of a two-week period, not all always on the same day. But, of course, I'll speak for my importers, and you can ask Council for Liberty to speak for their entry.
Okay. Yep. No, I will. That's part of my transition to checking in with Ms. Murphy at the end of this process. So we'll get there. Okay. Ms. Jossan, is that also the government's understanding?
That is my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So then let's turn back to you, Ms. Jossan. I mean, if everything's been liquidated, I mean, explain to me, help me understand the basis for your statement that C jurisdiction is available at the end of this proceeding.
Sure. If you look, partly it's the structure of 1517 does not say anything about, liquidation of entries like 1516A does and a preliminary injunction, which is what Your Honor had mentioned as well. Under Zenith, there's a different statutory structure.
Have a case of controversy? If the race of the investigation, the imports in question that were allegedly evading the duties have all been liquidated and have all been liquidated with the dumping duties that the government says were due, and plaintiff has no basis because of the finality of that liquidation, has no ability to get a refund pursuant to the C jurisdiction. Do they have a case to make under C?
I believe they would, Your Honor. If you look at, again, under the EPA statute, yes, liquidation of entries is one thing, and that is, for ADCVD purposes. But the structure and the EPA statute itself, there's other provisions that come into play and other measures that Customs can take upon a final affirmative determination. For example, if you look at Section 1517D1E, that section allows Customs to take additional enforcement measurements, which might be a penalty action in the future. So there's other repercussions of a EPA determination, a final affirmative determination, aside from just the liquidation of specific entries at play. So I think that's a distinguishing factor as well between the EPA statute and 1516A and the structure of commerce cases under that provision.
Okay. Now, you're presuming, of course, an affirmative finding. What if it's a negative finding?
Mm-hmm. If there's a negative finding, well, they have a protest mechanism here as well. To the extent these were prematurely liquidated, their remedy is to file a protest with Customs. And again, upon filing that protest, upon filing a protest, my understanding is Customs would keep that protest open until there's a final EPA determination. Should that be negative, Customs, within the context of the protest, would accordingly take that into consideration and adjust the rate to whatever it needs to be. So there is a mechanism there for plaintiff to get the remedy if there is ultimately a negative. We just don't know yet. This is all very premature, right? We just, the investigation hasn't concluded. That's the whole point here. We just, this could go many different ways. We just don't know yet.
Yeah. If, I'll turn to you in a minute, Mr. Menegas, but let me just, one other follow-up on this front, and that is 28 U.S.C. 2643A1, monetary damages. Would that provision support the award of monetary damages to plaintiffs here in a C case if they prevail on a challenge to an affirmative EPA determination or affirmative scope ruling?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I would have to look that up. I don't think I have that answer offhand right now, but I'm happy to look into it. What was that statute again, if you can repeat?
Yep. 28 U.S.C. 2643A1.
Again, I can look that up and come back to that if I have any thoughts. I just haven't.
Yep.
It's not something that's been made aware.
Okay. Mr. Menegas, let me give you a chance to chime in here.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is different from all the cases they cited because we don't think it's credible that they inadvertently liquidated these entries. And in the circumstance where the law provides a normal course for jurisdiction, the agency can't have the power to voluntarily choose a different course than the one Congress set out. And so to allow them to do this and merely ask us to protest the entries, we don't think it's appropriate. Now, of course, we will protest the entries at the 180th day when we have to if we don't, you know, if we aren't really much further down the road by that time. And that's why, you know, I'm very glad we're having this call now, because if the court can, you know, will decide or can decide that they can voluntarily correct this, then that would at least address that problem. But, you know, that there's a radical difference between, you know, protest and denial of protest and appeal to the court under 28 U.S.C. 1581A and appeal through C or I. And so, and it has, it's much more favorable to the government. And so we just don't think they should have the right to basically steer any EPA case they want into a jurisdiction of the courts. So, you know, that's, I haven't considered your other question about monetary damages, but, you know, part of, you know, under I, you have, you know, administration enforcement of the trade laws, you have manifest inadequacy. Part of all this is that, you know, the exporter, who was really the target, even though they weren't called a target in the investigation, they, you know, they held on for the year thinking they would get a decision. And it's, you know, it's not easy to hold on for a year when you have a 200% tax. You have U.S. companies with the COVID that are saying they can't survive 2 months. And so the very fact that they've manipulated these laws to extend them into a 600 or 700 day investigation is part of the harm, that this company is going to become less and less able to respond to the Commerce's parallel proceeding, which itself we believe is unlawful. And I think it is important for the court to understand that when you look at the totality of the referral and the way Commerce interpreted it, it's a plain vanilla anti-circumvention analysis, which under longstanding Commerce regulations and court precedent can only be prospective. In other words, the importer should have no liability in the way that Customs teed up this.
Well,
scope question.
I mean, Mr. Menegas, you're kind of veering into some of the merits, and I mean, you know, I will concede. I mean, having read through all the papers here, it's a very interesting case. I mean, a lot of interesting issues that for the agencies to decide, for the court to decide, et cetera. I'm not sure that we're at the point right now of deciding the merits issues. And, you know, the first hurdle we have to get over is deciding, you know, if and if so, what is the basis for the court's jurisdiction? So let me
right. Yeah,
okay.
So that's
why
I wanted to stress that's why I want to stress that that's part of the manifest inadequacy, that Pinewood is already closed and we're essentially defending the Commerce Department inquiry, which is kind of somewhere in the middle after 200 days, based on solely on the records that Finewood submitted to Customs and that were verified by Customs. And that's what we're stuck with, and it's very difficult because of the length of time they bled the company down to death. So that's part of the manifest inadequacy that would lend to the jurisdictional question.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Well, actually, I can skip this next question because we don't have any suspended. Okay. Mr. Sun, to the extent that the government's position is that the plaintiff now has to also pursue a protest and potentially a jurisdiction depending on the outcome of the protest, does that essentially suggest, doesn't that suggest that C jurisdiction by itself is manifestly inadequate to provide a remedy to plaintiffs?
When you're looking at, and I know I keep bringing it back to that, but it's almost, the complaint is alleging the evasion determination. The premature liquidation is almost a separate, almost a new or a separate cause of action. It's not,
well,
you know,
yeah, you're right. I get the point that you're making there, but again, part of the relief, part of the demand for relief in the complaint is liquidation without regard to AD/CVD duties. So, I mean, it's not completely distinct from the complaint. I mean, we'll get to. I do have some questions coming up about amending the complaint and such, and how far we can go on that front. But help me understand here the question. I mean, what I'm really just trying to figure out is if the fact that they have to pursue, because of the liquidation that's now occurred, is it accurate to say that C jurisdiction is now manifestly inadequate because it cannot provide all of the relief that they've requested? I mean, if they're entitled to it at the end of the case, obviously, but, you know, if the finding ultimately of the court is that, you know, there should have been a negative EPA determination, you know, subsequent to remands, et cetera, whatever the case may be, and they should have their entries liquidated without regard to dumping duties, the fact that I can't order that relief in strictly a C case, we have to have the protest and potentially an A case in addition or on parallel tracks or something, doesn't that make C jurisdiction manifestly inadequate?
I guess that's if the opinion is that Zenith and that case law applies, then sure. But I'm not entirely convinced, and perhaps this is something that, you know, we'd be happy to brief further if Your Honor would like it. But to the extent Zenith and those cases are distinguishable in a EPA context and for 1517 purposes, then I'm not sure that the court couldn't order such a remedy in the context of the C case.
Judge Barnett, it is Greg Menegas. Can I chime in at this point?
Hang on just a minute. Let me just, I want to think through what Ms. Jusan just said and see if, are you throwing out the possibility without necessarily committing the government to a position that theoretically under C jurisdiction in an EPA case, the court would have the ability to provide relief even with respect to liquidated entries?
Again, without just thinking aloud, thinking, you know, again, if the conclusion is that the Zenith cases, Zenith line of cases and the Zenith rule are distinguishable, again, yes, and without committing the government to this, because, again, we're happy to further brief this if Your Honor would like it. But, again, this is obviously all new issues, novel case law that's being developed here. You know, you're dealing with the interaction between Zenith line of cases, you're dealing with the new statute 1517, so there is a lot going on. And then you're also dealing with the customs protest statute here as well and the interplay between those statutes. That's what we're, you know, obviously mm-hmm. trying to iron out here and everything. And I think there is a lot there. You know, again, I can say we'd be happy to further brief that. I think there is a lot that could be thought out, but I don't think it's an open and shut in the sense that, no, there's definitely no the manifest inadequacy under C for them to bring for plaintiffs to bring a case later once we know, you know, which way this case is going to go, since there isn't a final decision yet from Customs.
Well, that may be a little bit of a chicken and egg issue there. I mean, because obviously the ability of the government to provide the ability and the ability of the court to provide complete relief pursuant to a C case may go to the question of, you know, otherwise address the question of the manifest adequacy or inadequacy of C, such that it touches on whether the court ends up with I jurisdiction or not. So, all right. Hold that thought. Make a note of that. I mean, I think that'll be a point definitely for follow-up. Mr. Menegas, you wanted to get in on this conversation?
Yes, I think this is what I have to say. It's directly relevant. And again, it's, apologize that this is complicated. I keep going back. But when you read the scope referral, it's very clear that Customs says, you know, we didn't basically find anything. We found no substantial evidence of evasion. But we need this scope question addressed by Commerce. So I think the only reasonable interpretation is that this proceeding, if it's still alive and not final and not out of time, is fully dependent on Commerce's scope ruling, which they've now engaged in. And those can go from 45 to 700 days. At the end of that process, Commerce publishes issues and decision memo and a Federal Register notice of a scope ruling of whatever form that takes, legal or not. And then that is independently appealable under 1516A. And if the entry is liquidated, that's when all that court precedent comes in and says, what are you doing here? We're not going to entertain an appeal over liquidated entries. In fact, Commerce is not even supposed to take up a scope referral for liquidated entries because it's all moot. So it's not like we're only dealing with the EFA statute here. The two are interlinked. And the guidance you have is the Dine and Sawblades appeals, which you may be familiar with, where there was a similar circumvention allegation and it turned into an anti-circumvention case at Commerce. And what the parties did there, because CBP did not liquidate the entry, is they had to separately appeal CBP's affirmative determination and Commerce's scope determination. And so, and they have, the court was able to take C jurisdiction under both. So that's kind of an example where, you know, you could at least argue there was some semblance of orderly procedure there, but we don't have that remedy with liquidated entry. We can't appeal the most important part of this case, which will be Commerce's scope determination.
Okay. All right. Give me just a second here.
I believe it's DTP, the company in some Thailand. I mean, we could get you the court numbers if that would help you after the call.
Right. I'm familiar. I'm familiar with the Sawblades cases.
Okay.
Let me go back to Ms. Josan then. Another side of the coin. I think you'll find I've got a multi-sided coin here that I'm playing with. If A jurisdiction mean, to the, again, this is going back to that manifest inadequacy and, you know, whether I versus now A jurisdiction. I mean, to the extent that A jurisdiction cannot resolve the EPA or scope determinations, is an A jurisdiction and also by itself manifestly inadequate.
I would bring it back to what's the cause of action here. If the cause of action is the premature liquidation, which is obviously a new cause of action that's not alleged in the complaint, nor could it be because it happened subsequently, then A is adequate for that cause of action. For the causes of actions that are alleged in the complaint currently, you know, we maintain that C would be adequate once a final determination is issued. So I think you have to bring it back to what the cause of action is here.
Okay.
I mean, this case...
Okay. Had you finished your thought? Or?
No, that's it.
Okay. Sorry. Mr. Menegas, anything further on this point?
Well, we would say that A is not adequate because it will bankrupt a lot of the potential plaintiffs because they'd have to pay all the duties before getting a jurisdiction in the court, which is not a requirement of C or I jurisdiction.
Well, they've paid all the duties at this point, right?
No, they have not. Customs recoded the entries type 3, issued notices of action, saying, you know, we think that these are Chinese plywoods. And we filed written opposition to Customs on that and said this is dependent on the outcome of the EPA investigation. And the entries just sat there for well over a year, almost 2 years, until this very recent liquidation by Customs. So now that they've issued liquidation notices, we have 180 days to protest those notices.
Okay. No, what was not clear to me was that at the time of recoding, whether your clients had made AD/CVD deposits at that point or not. Okay.
Right.
But they have not.
So, okay. These are very substantial millions of dollars to go from my clients. 206% taxes.
Right. So, all right, let me go back again to Ms. Jusan, and I mean, I think to some extent you probably have a sense, you know, we're not going to be surprised by this question. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to think about is from a legal perspective, when we talk about residual jurisdiction under I, you know, the question of whether jurisdiction is available under another subsection of 1581 and whether such jurisdiction would be manifestly inadequate. Is it that any one alternative basis has to be manifestly inadequate, or that they have to have one fully adequate alternative basis, or would it be the government's position that as long as some combination of actions and jurisdictional bases can provide adequate relief, that I is unavailable?
Again, thinking through this, and I'm probably repetitive at this point, but I think you have to keep bringing it back to the cause of action. So yes, they have an adequate remedy here for the alleged causes of action. For the causes of action alleged and
No,
my point. Your question.
Okay, now my point right now. But we can't say, and I think you would agree, right? That right now, as of this date, you can't say what alternative basis of jurisdiction is going to be adequate to give them relief. You would say, regardless of the circumstance, I mean, if it's a negative EPA determination, they have to go under A. If it's an affirmative EPA determination, well, they have to start under C. And if they're successful under C, they also have to go under A in order to get, or via the protest, to get the relief. And so my question is, and this is just, this is sort of more legal thinking question than a factual one.
Yeah.
And that is, does the question of the adequacy or inadequacy of an alternative jurisdictional basis, is it based on one jurisdiction, in order for me to find that I doesn't exist because C is available or C is manifestly inadequate, does it depend on whether I can give complete relief under C, or could it be that I is not available because even if C by itself is inadequate, if we mix C with protest and A, you can provide relief?
I think the real answer here, or part of, at least part of the answer, is that it, perhaps this is, for me at least, highlighting that much more why I is not available right now, because we don't know where this is going to end up. So,
well,
to the extent
others would argue that that's exactly why I is adequate, why I is appropriate right now, is because, I mean, that's the Rustani view from, what was it, Clearon, I think. Because we have no idea, you know, it's a, you can't expect the plaintiffs to have to play a game of whack-a-mole, jurisdictional whack-a-mole, that that she gave them I jurisdiction.
But again, I jurisdiction over what? Again, you know, over the fact that Customs didn't timely, you know, the allegation that Customs didn't timely conduct its investigation, or that they, you know, the scope referral was arbitrary and capricious. I jurisdiction over that, to the extent then that they would, you know, that doesn't lead to a negative evasion determination, which is what they're really seeking here. So to the extent there is I jurisdiction of the alleged causes of action, then again, the remedy they, plaintiffs are seeking, is no assessment of ADCVD duties, because there's, they want a negative evasion determination, but how do you get there when that Customs hasn't in the first instance made that determination itself? So I guess that's the, you know, that's what everything is, just leads, to me, leads back to the causes of action, what's being alleged, and what's really the true nature of what plaintiffs are seeking here. And they're ultimately seeking a negative evasion determination and no ADCVD duties.
Okay. Mr. Menegas?
Well, the entries have been liquidated as Type 3, and we have no ability to go to court to challenge that, because we'd have to challenge it under C, and the entries have liquidated.
Okay. Well, I think, and Ms. Jassans, I think, offered, if the court asks, and trust me, the court will ask at the end of this, for the government to do, you know, additional, I'm not sure if it would be additional briefing, but basically to go back and ask the question of her clients and come back with a government position to which they would be bound in terms of whether they would argue a lack of jurisdiction or not in a C challenge to an EPA determination, even if the entries were liquidated. Okay.
Okay, but we can't collaterally attack that decision if we can't attack Commerce's scope ruling.
Is Jassan?
Yes, Your Honor.
Any response to Mr. Menegas's?
I that's not something I've actually fully vetted or discussed with the agency. I'm not sure about the scope inquiry, or, you know, to the extent that whether that would be challengeable or not at the conclusion of Commerce's proceeding.
Okay. Maybe you can add that to your list of questions to provide additional information on the subsequent to this discussion. So let me, speaking of Commerce's actions here, let me ask, in the court's May 8th order, government was ordered to file a statement regarding the legal bases for liquidating the entries subject to the pending EPA investigation and the scope inquiry. Government statement addressed the EPA investigation and acknowledged that it was erroneous to liquidate when the EPA investigation was still ongoing. That same statement seemed to indicate that the government considers that Commerce acted properly in ordering the liquidation as a result of the conclusion of the administrative review. Let's look at 19 CFR 351.225L. It requires Commerce to continue the suspension of liquidation of unliquidated entries as of the date of initiation of a scope inquiry, which in this case occurred on January 17, 2020. Where does that regulation fit in here? Wasn't at that point Commerce obligated to rescind or revise or amend its liquidation instructions to with respect to Vietnam Fine Wood to indicate that anything that remained unliquidated that was subject to the scope inquiry should remain unliquidated pursuant to that regulation? Ms. Josan, sorry, that one was for you.
Okay, I apologize, but I don't think I'm going to have a response for that right now. I can add that to, the list of further explanations. That's not something I think I particularly honed in on. So if I misread the court's order, I apologize for that, but that's not something I...
Okay, well, I mean, I wasn't very specific about that question, but... The regulations pretty clearly provide once Commerce initiates the scope inquiry, anything that's suspended remains suspended pending the determination of the scope inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just that Commerce or Customs were erred in liquidating these entries when they were subject to the ongoing EPA investigation, but Commerce erred in not ensuring that the entries remained unliquidated, not withdrawing its liquidation instructions as to those entries. Mr. Menegas, anything you want to say on – or sorry, Mr. Simon?
No, I think we'd be happy to address that after this.
Mr. Menegas?
I would just add under longstanding practice, and it's also somewhere in the regulation that you cite, when the issue is a anti-circumvention third country manufacturing issue, they do remain suspended, and Commerce recognizes the unfairness of taking something that's made in a third country and just popping it in the order, and so it's only supposed to be effective from the date of initiation, which in our case, if you agree, is January 17, 2020, which there were no shipments on or after that date. But what they do, in light of the way these cases come up, is they invite the entries to be part of the next review that's available once the final affirmative determination is made that they're in the scope. Or they invite a use of a fact available from that kind of review. In other words, they realize that by the time they've made the decision that the normal opportunity to participate in the annual review process is not there for the importers or the exporter, and so they make some kind of accommodation. And so all of that is not possible with liquidated entry. So
right. Is your point with regard to circumvention inquiries, though, is that really relevant? Because Commerce is not conducting, at least not yet, is not conducting a circumvention inquiry. I mean, they were fairly clear, I think, in their notice of initiation that they, quote, may consider conducting a separate anti-circumvention inquiry, but that's not what they initiated.
But their description of the scope referral was whether plywood manufactured in Vietnam is in the scope of the orders. So even though they cited self-initiation, which we also disagree with since it was clearly referred, they are asking themselves a circumvention question very clearly. They're not asking themselves, is the product that was exported from Vietnam in the scope of the orders or not? Because clearly it's not, but that's why they're very confused. They were all scrambling after this case was finished for some kind of way to keep these importers on the hook. And so what they're actually doing to us is not a simple question, is to ply substrate in the scope of the order or not. It's whether plywood manufactured in Vietnam from veneers and two-ply substrate is subject to the orders. And that can only be done under the rubric of a circumvention analysis. And, I would note that, the alleger never filed a case brief, never entered that scope proceeding. The petitioners who did enter that scope proceeding, the true petitioners, did not ask for a circumvention inquiry by the deadline set in that proceeding. But yet Commerce is asking us all kinds of questions and on the verge of the next step will be a massive supplemental questionnaire that we likely can't answer, frankly, that we'll try to get at, things like the relative value of a product manufactured in Vietnam versus the product manufactured in China. It's extremely complex because it's a non-market case. You can't just look at books. You have to get surrogate values from China and Vietnam to even answer that question. And so we're looking at the nature of what they've taken the scope referral to be, and it can only be interpreted as an anti-circumvention inquiry.
Okay. All right. Ms. Jassan, anything you wanted to say in response? Or
just that I think this is getting way beyond the jurisdictional issue in the sense that we're getting into the merits. And I understand that the scope ruling started in January in this complaint, but none of this is alleged in the complaint either. Again, nor could it have because Commerce's scope was later on. It started in January. So to the extent there's a lot of things going on here, and I think we're getting way into the merits than just purely obviously the first thing of jurisdiction here. And I understand there's some overlap, but I would, Mr. Menegas, everything he's getting into, this is getting way beyond the scope of just the jurisdictional issue. It's getting into the merits and, frankly,
well,
obviously we're not in a position.
Right. I mean, I get your point there, and I mean, it's one that, I understand and have made that point earlier in this conversation. But at the same time, in terms of the government's actions here, there is also a question, when you have a pending court case, whether the government has intentionally or unintentionally or inadvertently taken actions that would effectively and inappropriately try to remove or deny the court jurisdiction with regard to the case at hand. And so that's part of what we're looking at this point as well. Let me go back because this is Mr. Menegas kind of alluded to this issue a few minutes ago, and that is just, again, sort of a factual question for clarity at this point. And that is, were any of the plaintiff importers or Vietnam Fine Wood as an exporter from Vietnam, were any of these companies party to the administrative review that led to Commerce issuing liquidation instructions to CBP?
Well, let me start with Pinewood. They, you know, they requested review kind of as a precaution, as we advise many clients to do, and it was extremely awkward because we had to request review as a potential exporter of potential subject merchandise, and the petitioners did not request review of Pinewood, and Pinewood then timely withdrew its review request because we were thinking, well, how do we file a dumping response based on individual veneers? It's really not in scope of the order. So we don't know how to do that, and CBP's decision that these were even potentially subject was, you know, ex parte and only based on a reasonable suspicion. And so based on those facts, Pinewood withdrew its timely withdrew its request, and so there was no review of Pinewood. Now, some of the importers, I believe, Far East has entered an appearance. I would have to double check that because, you know, there's many exporters and, you know, various importers import from different exporters. So, again, I would have to double check that, but it would not have related to these shipments as the bottom line. Whatever participation.
Sorry, can you repeat that last? Can you repeat that last statement?
I didn't hear. Far East and Interglobal entered appearances at all. We could easily double check that. It would not have been specific to exports from Pinewood because they were only conditionally, you know, determined to possibly be of Chinese origin. So there's like 200 exporters from China. There's other exporters that sell to these imports.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if Pinewood has withdrawn, then its shipments are not subject to the review. And so if the EIPA decision is negative, then the review has no impact on it. And so that's why I mentioned that point before, which I thought was directly, you know, related to your question about manifest inadequacy, that when you have an analysis that ends up as an anti-circumvention analysis, what Commerce does to compensate for parties who only find out 700 days after the fact, that the circumvention inquiries tend to go on forever, they kind of try to fit them in to the next upcoming review or use some kind of facts available from the review process as a surrogate for their margin. But we don't have that right here because our entry is liquidity.
Right. Okay. Mr. San, anything you wanted to say on this issue?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. To the extent that plaintiffs considered, Vietnam Pinewood, to the extent Vietnam Pinewood considered that all their entries were non-subject during that POR, I mean, is there any way that they could have claimed party to the proceeding status to protect their interest in what was going on in the administrative review and to otherwise have taken steps within the context of the commerce proceeding structure to avoid having commerce issue the determination that it did and resulting in the liquidation instructions that went out applying to Vietnam Pinewood?
Well, we don't think that's reasonable to expect them to fully participate in an anti-dumping review, which is really the issue here because the all others rate in the countervail case is 22%, and that's not driving this case or this litigation. It's 183% for the dumping. And you don't have to participate in a CBD case to get the all others rate. You know, people who never showed up ever get the all others rate unless they fail to answer quantity value. So it's really about the dumping. They shouldn't have to go through a full-blown administrative proceeding at Commerce based on a 45-day ex parte decision by Customs that they might be in the scope. That's not the statutory framework. The statutory framework is to suspend the entry and let CBP do its job and find out if there was an evasion. And so, and then they were thinking, you know, since the scope of the orders clearly says a core, a face, and a back, i.e. three plies, and they were only exporting individual veneers and two ply from China, that they were clearly outside the scope of the orders, that they didn't have any in-scope merchandise to report.
Okay. Mr. Sun?
I don't have anything further, Your Honor. I'm not as
okay.
familiar with what's going on with the commerce proceeding. So, you know, to the extent the court would, you know, need that information, I can certainly loop back. But I'm not right now as familiar with the ongoings of the scope inquiry.
Right. Okay. Mr. Menegas, in your comments on the defendant's statement, you relied a fair bit on what Judge Gordon did in Infang. I mean, let me just ask you, isn't Infang really clearly distinguished by the fact that that case was a consolidated case in which the two consolidated cases, one was based on I jurisdiction and the other based on C jurisdiction? So it's hard to take too much from what Judge Gordon was able to do in that particular case?
Well, you know, the game of whack-a-mole, we tried to do everything we could to protect the client once we realized an issue was liquidated, because we were the plaintiff, as you probably figured that out. And, you know, I think the judge took offense to the fact that Commerce and Customs were working together to evade the statutory scheme. And that's what we think is happening here, that they've evaded the statutory scheme and potentially set themselves up to pick their own statutory scheme. And so all he was doing was saying, I'm not going to put up with this. You guys have to show me why you shouldn't unliquidate this entry or do it yourselves. And rather than fight with the judge, they just said, okay, we'll do it. We'll unliquidate the entries.
Pursuant to an order.
So, I mean, okay. It's not exactly parallel, because this implicates this whole notion of, you know, not giving people 60 days to file appeals. So that might have been driving the court's decision, but the common point is that the agencies undermine the normal statutory scheme.
Right. Okay.
So he had to do both, I mean, what he did is he consolidated them, and then we agreed to dismiss the I claim voluntarily in conversations with the Justice Department after the Justice Department told us, one, we're going to unliquidate the entry, and two, we're not going to raise this as a substantive claim in subsequent litigation. We agreed to voluntarily dismiss the I claim, the I appeal from the consolidated appeals, and the judge granted that order.
Right. Okay. Ms. Jusen, anything you wanted to add there?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. The Infang case, I think, again, just for simple fact of jurisdiction, is distinguishable. You know, that being said, the agencies here aren't evading the statute or purposely doing anything here. We have to be mindful of the fact that this is a new statute. You know, it's a new statute. The interplay between the agencies and everything that's what's bringing up these issues. But the government isn't purposely here evading the statute on purpose, doing this to plaintiffs. There's no ill intent here, which is what plaintiffs keep saying here. So I would like to put that marker there. The government's not doing anything intentionally here to purposely, you know, void the court of jurisdiction or, you know, dragging this on for the plaintiffs.
Well, but at the same time, I think you would agree that given the novelty of the statute at play here, that it's important to establish clear markers both for the agencies and for the court and for the parties, the private parties, importers, exporters, et cetera, as to what the expectations are in terms of how entries and are going to be treated, both with regard to suspension and the preservation of the suspension. And here, notwithstanding the fact that there are some fairly clear regulations, I think, that address that, there were also equally clear failings on the part of both agencies. I take your point, and I think that I don't know that that diminishes the importance of dealing with the failings on the part of the agencies here either. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, did you want to add anything? Or?
No, that's it, Your Honor.
Okay. So let's go back, I mean, one more time, revisit this, the issue of a protest here for a minute. That is, I mean, the government argues that the liquidations are amenable to protest, but I guess one question there is, does that depend on whether, on whether customs actions evince an inadvertence or mistake that customs can correct? And I note here that customs appears merely to have acted in a ministerial fashion on the basis of commerce's instructions. So if the error, you know, so one question is this even protestable, given that, I mean, I think the position that commerce, or sorry, that customs has taken in the past is that, you know, as long as what customs is doing is faithfully carrying out the instructions of commerce, that that is a non-protestable ministerial act because there is no decision or determination being made by customs.
Is this a question for plaintiff's counsel?
No, this is for the government. They're the, because they're the ones that are trying to point you down the protest line. Is this protestable? I mean, normally speaking, the position of the government has been that ministerial acts by customs are non-protestable. So to what extent is this, I mean, how is the government's position that this is protestable consistent with that position there, that, you know, that you cannot protest a ministerial act by customs? And let me just say, I mean, is one possibility, I mean, is it the government's position that customs in fact did err by failing to check whether the entities named in the instructions were subject to an ongoing IPA related suspension of liquidation? What is the inadvertence? What is the protestable act that the government would identify?
This would be protestable. The protestable act is the fact that these were prematurely liquidated and that they should have remained suspended pursuant to the IPA investigation. So, the premature liquidations, they were inadvertent in the sense that customs didn't keep them suspended when they should have been. So they should not have been suspended. That's a protestable, a premature liquidation is a protestable act by customs. So I think this is distinguishable from those other ministerial cases where, you know, because again, this should have continued to be suspended until customs concluded the IPA investigation.
Mr. Benegas, anything you wanted to say to that specifically?
Well, we think this is fraught with peril. The government can change their position at any time, to especially when they don't want to be in court. But let's just say that we were, you know, forced to protest in 180 days, and they do suspend adjudication of the protest that they've indicated. And then the next thing that will happen is Commerce will issue a scope decision. And then it goes through a multi-day, maybe 100-day process at CBP, even if they're allowed to do that based on all our pleading, with an investigation literally being over. But, you know, then all of a sudden, within 30 days, we'd have to appeal Commerce's scope decision if we lose, which, you know, we're anticipating that we will, because we think this is the whole thing is results-driven. But just let's say we lose. Then we have liquidated entries. And the court will toss us out and we'll never be able to appeal the most important issue in this case, which is whether these frauds are in scope.
Okay. One of the issues with regard to the manner in which liquidation occurred, Ms. Jossan, did Customs also err to the extent that they're seeking to liquidate at the rate of 200%+ as opposed to the 0%, based on the fact that the instructions to Customs were to liquidate at the cash deposit rate in effect at the time of entry. Can you identify support for the government to interpret that language at the time of entry to include subsequent changes that are made by CBP?
I'm not entirely sure of that answer, Your Honor. That's something I'm in the process of trying to figure out. I'm not sure about the rate itself, and in particular whether or not, which is, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, which you might be getting at, is whether the instructions themselves were properly followed or not, in this case by Customs. And I'm not sure about the answer to that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I can certainly, again, find out and...
Okay. Add that to your homework list. Okay. All right. Mr. Menegaz, anything you wanted to say on that front?
Well, we think it's very clear that at the time these entries were made, the plywood was manufactured in Vietnam. And the only way you get them into an order at all is by expanding the order under an anti-circumvention third country minor completion and assembly analysis.
Well, all right. Okay. I mean, you're moving on to the substance. Okay.
No, but the fact is at the time of entry.
I mean, that's the same. But Mr. Menegaz, I've read through all the materials and it's a fascinating question. I mean, I understand very well your point. I completely get it. And at the same time, I mean, I also have read and I understand, it's language that I think Customs makes clear in their referral to Commerce. And that is, I mean, they basically say, hey, this is a weird situation where rules of origin meet substantial transformation. We look at this material at the time it enters. At the time it enters, physically it meets the definition of subject merchandise. And then we go back and look at where is it coming from. Well, under our rules of origin, there was no substantial transformation in Vietnam. And because there was nothing that meets our Customs definition of substantial transformation, the country of origin of this material happens to be China. Now, so there's how they get to, well, maybe this stuff is subject. But I get your point. Your argument is it's not subject when it comes out of China. And so how does it end up under a dumping order? I get it. So it makes it a really interesting case. I don't know the answer to that legal question. I mean, we got to figure that out. I mean, Commerce has to figure it out in the first instance. After Commerce figures out their response to it, Customs has to go run it through their filter of evasion. And then depending on the outcome of that, potentially depending on the outcome of the Commerce proceeding with regard to the scope inquiry and C jurisdiction on that, subject to questions outstanding for government counsel, B, running it through the filter over at Customs and what does it mean in terms of EPA and the question of evasion and that determination and potential C litigation there. We got a lot of interesting legal questions here. I understand all that. I don't know that they're teed up yet for the court, but at the same time, had this question arisen without the government overlay of liquidating all your entries, I think, you're in a much more difficult position in terms of jurisdiction. I mean, the government's done you a favor sort of trying to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory by liquidating all your entries here. And that's what I'm simply trying to figure out. How do I walk through this minefield of issues, legal, factual, jurisdictional, to come out someplace that makes sense out of all of this? So, I mean, I really get your points here. I want to try to focus on, I'm trying to ask very precise questions. Without sort of going back and revisiting all of the concerns throughout here. So, I mean, with that said, is there something that you wanted to add on that specific question in terms of Customs' ability to interpret the language about in effect at the time of entry to include subsequent changes in status from type 1 to type 3 by customs?
Well, I guess we don't have any sense of comfort that they're going to agree with us, because you know we've maintained in our pleadings that the rate in effect at entry was zero, but we don't have any comfort that the agencies will agree with us on that. So,
Do you have legal authority? Yeah. I mean, do you have any? I mean, is there anything in the regulations, anything in case law that speaks to the question?
Well, we have their email to us saying that we follow the instructions of customs, but that really dodges the question, doesn't it? Because Commerce only issued the instructions because CBP started the process by recoding. So we're kind of chasing our tails on this. And so we don't have a lot of comfort in that. I think we have two main concerns. One, you know, if they can set a precedent of doing the scope referral on the last day, 360 days, they can do it in every case, and companies will be killed. Companies can't hold out that long. It's not reasonable to ask them to wait 2 years to go to court to challenge. And that we don't have this opportunity to challenge Commerce's scope referral now because of the liquidation. So that's why we said in our pleadings that this enhances our case, but it's not the only grounds for our case. I mean, if the ruling is that they can basically do whatever they want with their law and their regulations and do what they did in this extreme case, then that's really tough for importers and exporters, because without ever getting to the merits, they can put companies out of business very easily.
Okay. So let's go on. Ms. Jasan, talk about Xinye for a moment. I mean, does Xinye support the court's exercise of eye jurisdiction if we had an amended complaint that was for the limited purpose of challenging Commerce's liquidation instructions to potentially return those entries to a suspended status?
Just for the liquidations or over the
yes.
IPA?
No, for the liquidation
case as well.
Just the liquidations.
I'm not having read in a while. I'm trying to recall back the precedent. I'm not sure offhand whether, you know, if the premature liquidations, again, if it's that that Customs didn't follow Commerce's instructions, could the court order reset under that context, under eye jurisdiction? I'm not sure. Because I'm also not sure if, you know, whether the merit to whether Customs followed Commerce's instructions or not either.
Okay.
So not the answer you're looking for, but I'm not sure.
Right. Okay. I mean, alternatively, or maybe, you know, additionally, I mean, do you think Xinye would support an I case that sought relief in the form of a reliquidation eventually, pending either a negative IPA determination or judicial review of an affirmative IPA determination? In other words, what we would have is an I case that would be filed now, but that would, and it would establish jurisdiction with regard to the entry in question, but essentially would then be stayed pending resolution of the IPA investigation and any subsequent litigation.
I think I'm following what you're saying. I'm just, you know, I'm not sure. I can certainly look into that and respond accordingly, but offhand, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Whether
we
agree with that or not.
Oh, sorry. Okay. All right. Add that to the homework list. Mr. Menegas?
Well, I mean, that's kind of, you know, our approach in Infong was that we'll have to do everything that we have to do, including protesting and filing new I claims within 2 years of the liquidations. we'll do whatever we have to do. If the judge says, you know, that you'll assert jurisdiction if we amend our complaint, but we'll happily do that as well. It just seems, you know, to be a lot to do. It's this game of jurisdictional ping pong. So, you know, that's why we were hoping that we had made the case for extraordinary circumstances in the first instance, and just commenting that the liquidation is really kind of the final nail in the coffin of, you know, securing jurisdiction.
Right. Okay. So let me ask you both to address then, maybe we'll start with you, Mr. Hassan. I mean, to the extent, this is, you know, just thinking about this, you know, a bit creatively here. I mean, to the extent that an I case, though, would be a bit substantively different, I think, than what's now, the complaint that's now before the court. Do I have enough jurisdiction, let's say, to allow or to order an amendment to the existing complaint? In other words, you know, do we either have enough jurisdiction, or even in the absence of subject matter jurisdiction, can a Rule 15D supplementation of the complaint be one that is necessary to establish jurisdiction that might not have otherwise existed?
Is that to me first, Your Honor?
Yes. Yes, please.
Okay. As the case is on the amended complaint, no, the court, you know, as we continue to argue, the court does not have jurisdiction even to, you know, order an amendment. The liquidation of the entries are a new cause of action. And, you know, I think our current position is that is rightly protested under, you know, under the, you know, the premature liquidations, carbon activated kind of is very instructive therein. When there is a premature liquidation by customs, what is a plaintiff to do? What is an importer to do? And we think the Federal Circuit made it pretty clear, you protest that premature liquidation. That said, I understand the court's concern. I understand, you know, the way this case is prodding along and everything that's happening. And, you know, I certainly would be happy to go back and think whether there is another way to address all of this. But, you know, again, the premature liquidations themselves, which is really the new cause of action here, can be protested, and that is the right way or the, you know, proper mechanism here for plaintiffs.
Okay. Mr. Menegas?
Well, you know, we're not so sure that, you know, filing a new I complaint is that much more burdensome or different than seeking amendment. And it might be safer for us, because we guess that the government will oppose it and then we'll end a whole new briefing cycle in any event. So, I mean, we'd go either way, but we'd be, you know, inclined, you know, if that's what the court decides, that we need to do something new for the court, you know, because the court's not prepared to act on our initial basis, then we will have to put together, you know, we think the safest path for us, you know, because like you say, with the game of whack-a-mole, we don't know where this is going to end up in 5 years at the Federal Circuit. You know, it's probably safer for us to file a new I complaint and bring in CBP and Commerce, and we basically have a whole new appeal. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, this real ongoing harm to the importers based on the exporters' inability to, you know, duplicate and do more, given that they closed, is an ongoing harm. That, you know, it's going to be very unfortunate if we just have to play all that out.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can add, Your Honor,
please.
I think if an I case, you know, again, there wouldn't be an I case over proceedings that are still ongoing before Commerce and Customs, and that's exactly, you know, there's even a new cause of action alleging Commerce's action or Customs actions when those are still ongoing is not going to, you know, we would submit it doesn't allow the court to analyze the underlying issues anyway, because those are not final and they're not, you know, it still would be premature. To the extent of just the premature liquidations, again, there is an avenue. Customs would keep that protest open until the EPA investigation is over. So plaintiffs wouldn't be, you know, they wouldn't have to pay those duties. They wouldn't have to, because that protest would remain open. And that's exactly the point, is that customs would keep that protest open.
But that doesn't respond. I mean, Mr. Menegas's point was that may be well and good with respect to the EPA determination itself then ultimately, but it nevertheless deprives him and his clients of the ability to challenge the scope determination out of commerce under to challenge the scope determination directly out of commerce under the court's C jurisdiction. Yeah. And I think that's one where we still had an open question. I mean, I know you're going to look into that and get back to us. But I mean, I think that's right. But that's that is a separate matter on that front.
Understood.
Okay. Mr. Menegas, anything further you wanted to add on that?
No, I mean, I think we've more or less covered this ground. I think you've articulated our concerns, and I think you understand our concerns at this point.
Right. I mean, I understand it. I think I feel like I understand everybody's concerns, and I'm just trying to figure out what the reasonable path through this minefield is. And so to that extent, let me ask, I think this is my last question before Ms. Murphy gets to chime in here. So say that as a little alert to you, Ms. Murphy. So the last question I have is, if the court were inclined to find I jurisdiction, because A and C each appear to be manifestly inadequate, what actions, if any, would the court need to take in the immediate future to preserve its ability to provide full relief to the plaintiffs at the end of this case with regard to the liquidated entries, if such relief ends up being appropriate? I mean, is there anything that the court would need to do now to essentially establish a marker establish a marker against the finality of the liquidations that have occurred? Ms. Jossan, let me start with you.
If the court finds that jurisdiction exists, then we could, resetting the liquidations or unsetting the liquidations, what are the proper phraseologies here? But again, that's only once the court decides that it has jurisdiction over this case, which, again, we...
I think
that's what the action...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. I mean, I think... All right. No, we don't need to go into that further. Mr. Menegas, thoughts on that specific question?
Well, I suppose if... I'm not sure... I'm trying to figure out how that would look. I mean, if the court is going to take the pleadings as they stand and just say, well, we have a high jurisdiction and we're suspending this proceeding until the agencies decide when they want to finish their proceeding, that would be very, very little relief to us.
That's all right. But the specific question that I'm asking, Mr. Menegas, is there any action necessary by the court to preserve your client's ability to get relief with respect to the liquidated entries at the end of whatever that process might be? That's the legal question I'm asking right now.
Yeah. It gets back to the question of whether the complaint needs to be amended or whether we're better off filing a new complaint on that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it all, if you find that your only means of jurisdiction is due to the liquidations and not due to any of the activity of the agencies to date, you know, then I guess we're in the land of filing a brand new complaint. Because okay. If you're not going to stop the agencies, you know, then they're going to continue for an indefinite period of time, and the whole case will fracture, I believe, anyway. That some parties will go bankrupt and be forced into 1582 defending, you know, prosecutions for collections, and others that can pay the duties will proceed with I claims and C claims and try to let the court sort it out in a later year.
Good. All right. Thank you both. Ms. Murphy, let me just start off by asking, I mean, you know, the factual question, and that is, what's the status of your client's entries? Are they, in fact, all liquidated? And if so, is there any reason not to treat your complaint in intervention the same as any ultimate determination with regard to the plaintiff's complaint?
Thank you, Your Honor. All of our clients' entries were also liquidated that are relevant to the EPA investigation, and much like Mr. Menegas's importer clients, they had been entered as Type 1, and Customs recoded them as Type 3, and they were liquidated upon Commerce's instructions to CBP.
Okay. All right. Anything as we, you know, anything that you heard sort of at any point in this discussion today where you want to either register a note of distinction for your client from Mr. Menegas's clients, or either factual or in terms of legal argument or approach?
Sure. So I think I have one I wouldn't even say it's necessarily a factual distinction, but just point. Liberty Woods was not a party to the administrative review. I know that Mr. Menegas said Far East and InterGlobal may have been, but they wouldn't have been related to Finewood. I don't believe Liberty Woods was a party in any respect to the administrative review that ultimately led to the instructions by Commerce.
Okay.
And then with respect, I'm sorry. The only other comment I think that I would have from the discussion today is it appears to be the government's position that the importers involved in the EPA case need to jump through 15 different hoops in order to get total relief, right? File a protest, file an appeal from that protest, file an appeal when the EPA case is done, maybe do a separate I case to deal with the liquidations now if we don't want to file a protest. And it seems to me that is exactly the jurisdictional whack-a-mole that the court was talking about that shouldn't be permitted here. And while I am not, whether intentional or not, what the agencies are currently doing are creating an environment in which there is no way for our clients, our importer clients, to receive full relief from both the EPA investigation, the liquidations of the entries, the anti-dumping duties, the CVD duties in one place. And I believe that is what this court was essentially designed for. I mean, if you look at Rule 1 of the court's rules, it says its purpose is to provide efficient and complete relief in every action and proceeding, secure the just speed and inexpensive determination of every action and proceeding. And so from a jurisdictional basis, I agree with Mr. Menegas. I think our complaints have pled extraordinary circumstances such as as it currently stands, that jurisdiction exists. However, I think with the addition of what Customs and Commerce has done with respect to the liquidation of these entries, that furthers that jurisdiction. And so I do think that, that the court has the authority to allow us to amend the pleadings and include it all in there, because I think when you read it in its totality and not piecemeal, as the government suggests, there is a true claim here for both the liquidation of the entries and for what Commerce and Customs are doing with respect to the EPA investigation.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
That's it for me.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Jassan, anything you wanted to say in response?
And just quickly, and I know I've said it, so I'll make it very brief. Just, again, the question comes back to what is our jurisdiction over here? It's over a negative, you know, what plaintiffs are seeking here, it's over a negative evasive determination. We don't have that yet. We don't have a final determination. So again, it keeps looping back to that. What is the I? What would the I jurisdiction over this case look like right now? What exactly would the court be able to adjudicate here when there isn't a final determination from either agency? But so I would just put that in. You know, so even amending the complaint isn't for subsequent actions. I know Your Honor mentioned Rule 15D for a supplemental pleading. That's a separate provision that I guess possibly could be possible. But again, amendment, you know, the cause of action has to be at the time, and you assess jurisdiction at the time of the complaint and the cause of action. So,
yeah, but Ms. Jassan, you should never argue without actually looking at the terms of the rule that you're referencing. I mean, I was specific to D because it does specifically refer to permitting a party to serve a supplemental pleading, setting out any transaction, occurrence, or event that happened after the date of the pleading to be supplemented. And it goes on to say the court may and I can permit supplementation even if the original pleading is defective in stating a claim or defense.
Yeah, no, I know. I agree with supplementation. Amending the complaint. No, I was just making the distinguish between the amending the complaint versus a supplemental complaint.
Okay.
That's it. I agree that there is the avenue of the supplemental for subsequent action, possibly. But for amending the complaint, I was just trying to make that distinction.
So I'm sorry. So let me ask you to repeat the distinction or the significance of that distinction with respect to the current situation. Make sure that I understand your position.
Meaning that it wouldn't be an amendment to the complaint. If there's a possibility of a supplemental complaint for subsequent actions, yes, Rule 15D speaks to that. Whether that would apply in this scenario, I'm not, you know, taking a position at this point on. I know you had asked that question earlier.
Right. Okay. Okay. So, you're still reserving on the question of can they resolve a jurisdictional defect through supplementation under 15D?
Right.
You're going to get back to us on that. Okay. All right. Anything else? I mean, we need to talk about timelines and such in a moment. Anything substantive at this point that we haven't gotten to that we need to further address at the moment? Okay. Hearing nothing. Sorry.
Judge Barnett, sorry, for a minute ago. Just to clarify my earlier position and to be consistent with Liberty's counsel, if we were permitted to amend under this rule, it would speed things up because ultimately, you know, we don't mind spending years in court arguing over whether Customs and Commerce acted legally if Commerce is enjoined from continuing to investigate Pinewood. And so it would be a speedier option for us to amend because otherwise we have 2 years to file a new I complaint from the liquidations and we might end up thinking we need to wait that time. We have to think about that. So before I said I preferred a new case, I'm clarifying that I would support the amendment process if that's where the judge goes.
And I think you actually meant to say supplement rather than amend to take into account subsequent actions?
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Ms. Yosan, you got a lot of homework on your plate. Let me ask you thoughts about a time frame and think about a fairly aggressive time frame. I know I'm sure you'd appreciate more rather than less time, but I don't want to let this drag out. And I think you keep in mind the kind of deadlines that the court's been setting lately with respect to the actions that have occurred here. Let me give you the first opportunity to at least propose something that you think is marginally reasonable before I give you a deadline that's, of course, completely unreasonable.
More time would be great, but I understand the time frames and everything. I would appreciate a date next week at the earliest instead of this week sometime, given that this is Wednesday.
Right.
So I would certainly appreciate, next week at the earliest.
Fair enough. Any objection to next Thursday, the June 4, from anybody? And so I think the way I would like to set this up is we'll give the government a deadline of next Thursday to supplement its response to the questions that the court has posed today. And then I will give plaintiffs and plaintiff interveners a period of time to respond to the government's supplementation of its responses. So if we do next Thursday for the government, in part recognizing, because I think some of these questions you're going to have to coordinate with folks at different places, and I know it's that much more challenging these days with people working remotely and such. So next Thursday for the government and then the following Thursday, the 11th, for plaintiffs and plaintiff interveners, does that seem not too unreasonably reasonable for everyone? Any objections?
Yes, Your Honor. That's fine, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's fine, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. And I would encourage you all to, when you can, when appropriate, whether it's in the aftermath of this phone call or after you've, in another day or so after you've had a chance to digest some of the questions from the court and where it may indicate the court is or is not leaning, or whether you have to wait until maybe after next Thursday when the government's provided some additional clarity in terms of its positions. But to the extent that you all can speak creatively between yourselves and try to, help the court come up with a way through the minefield, I would encourage you to do so. I will tell you, I'm thinking clearly about this. Thinking hard about this. I've thought a lot about it. It's as much of an interesting issue as it is. I will be fully honest with you in that the court had some serious questions as to jurisdiction at this point until the question of liquidation arose. And I do think there are, notwithstanding the distinctions associated with Zenith, I think there may well be some ways in which C jurisdiction becomes manifestly inadequate as a result of these liquidations. And while I'm not inclined to get to the underlying question of evasion, yes or no, in scope, yes or no, without an actual determination by either agency. And I don't think that the plaintiffs have, to this point, sufficiently pled that I've got jurisdiction with regard to that question at this time. I nevertheless am concerned that there may well be jurisdiction with regard to the application of a determination that has not in fact been made over the entries in question and the liquidation thereof, where the court may in fact have some jurisdiction, whether it has been pled or remains to be pled in a supplement, which again raises additional questions of its own. So I would appreciate all of you continuing to think about those questions, and I don't want this to be a case where bad facts make bad law. And so if you all can, and which creates a risk for each side, frankly. And so to the extent that you all can find a way to work cooperatively to minimize the short-term issues and allow the court to get to the real issues at the appropriate time, I think that would be a productive exercise for everybody. So I would encourage you to, separate from the exercise of responding to the questions, supplementing your response to my questions next Thursday and responding to that the following Thursday, I would encourage you all to find some time to try to speak creatively amongst yourselves as well. So that said, anything further we need to address today for the good of the order?
No, Your Honor. I don't think so. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hassan. Mr. Menegas?
Nothing more, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. And Ms. Murphy?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all. At this point, we'll continue to work on this. And let me just say, Jeff, if you want to stop the recording, let me just, everybody doing okay out there?